history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. They won't claim that title for themselves, but we can certainly ascribe it once we take the time to listen to some of the things they went through for the sake of our country. The idea here is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we do so, we learn quite a bit. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This doesn't happen too often on Hometown Heroes, but every once in a while we run into a story that just isn't going to fit into one episode of the show, so we have to carry it over. If you missed last time, you can find the whole podcast at hometownheroesradio.com. But we're talking to Lawson Sakai of Morgan Hill, California, who served with the 442nd Regimental Combat Team in Europe during World War II. We heard about how he and his Japanese-American family were forced from their Southern California home in the months that followed the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, how he tried to enlist in the Navy only to be told he was ineligible because of his ancestry. Later, he even spent a month in the Navy's V-12 program as a student before they discovered his Japanese heritage. And finally, in 1943, the formation of the 442nd gave him the opportunity to serve. We heard about the rescue of the Lost Battalion, that unit surrounded by German forces in France's Vosges Mountains in October 1944, and then eventually rescued by the Japanese Americans of the 442 at a very heavy cost. We're going to hear the rest of Mr. Sakai's story today, and even hear from one of the men he helped rescue. But let's start out with something that maybe you caught a little of last time, Lawson Sakai's description of the conditions he faced in the Vosges Mountains and how a German shell knocked him out of commission 2 days before that rescue was complete.
The weather was so bad, and of course we didn't have winter clothing, and we're soaking wet from the rain, and the hills were muddy. We're in the Vosges Mountains, the thickest forest that we'd ever been in. And the Germans had the 88-millimeter anti-aircraft weapon, lowered it down, and started shooting it at the infantry. That sound of that 88 going off and exploding, that shrill sound coming, is something that I've never heard duplicated in movies or anything. It's just mind-shattering. I mean, when it comes directly at you, wow, you know, it just, the sound itself is enough to blow you apart. But when it would hit these trees, branches would come off. Sometimes half of a tree would come falling, weighing maybe 1,000 pounds. A lot of guys got crushed. And the morning that I got hit, the 28th of October, we're going to mount a real strong attack at daybreak. And the Germans probably sensed that we were, because we had had a big battle on the 27th. We gained the high ground. We dug in as best we could. That early that morning, the barrage came in, probably lasted 20, 25 minutes, maybe more. I don't know. Maybe 100 rounds, just bang, 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 just continuously. We were pinned down. You couldn't move. We had a lot of casualties right at that time. And, of course, when I got it, well, I thought I was dead, so I was out of it. But
I imagine you had probably had some close calls before that.
Yeah, I got wounded twice in Italy and then once before in France. So, but they weren't that bad, you know.
Well, define that, because you say, yeah, I got wounded once. Well, yeah, and most people have never been wounded, period. So when you say weren't that bad, what do you mean?
You know, I got patched up and I could go back a day or two. Mm-hmm. But the last time, the shrapnel that got me in, if it came straight through, it would have blown a hole through me, but it came in at an angle, so it wrapped around in my ribs here. Oh, that was really painful. It just, you know, a red-hot piece of steel in there, and it just, your body just gives way. It just curl up and you can't breathe. And I was sure I was dead. I remember I told the medic, just let me die right there. And he pumped me full of morphine, because when I woke up, I was on a train, on a litter. They were going to the American Hospital in Dijon, which is not too far away, for surgery. And I don't know how I survived that one. But guys were getting killed left and right, you know. Mostly the barrage from the artillery, just an awful shattering of not only the artillery shell, but the tree trunks and limbs coming down. In Italy, we had a few vineyards, a few olive orchards. Most of the hills were bare. Got to France and eastern France, and all of a sudden this huge forest that we had to go through. The Germans were already entrenched, dug in, so we had to go into the forest, dig them out.
You're going into a meat grinder.
Yeah.
What about your recovery? How long did it take to recover from those wounds?
About 3 months, but not too long after October 30, when the 211 men were rescued, Dahlquist pushed the 442nd for another 4 or 5 days before he let them come off the line.
Right.
We had so few men left. I think I Company had 8 out of 250 or so.
8 out of 250.
Yeah. I think our company, E Company, had probably the most. From what I heard, we had about 40 men left. But the 442nd really couldn't do much in it. They're just depleted. So they were sent to southern France, between Italy and France, and a hillside where, like the Maginot Line, they had fortresses built. And the duty was to guard the French-Italian border and the port cities of Cannes, Nice, and that area, patrol all of that. They called it the Champagne Campaign because there was very little battle going on. But there was a few. One of my friends, Sakamoto from the Valley, he got killed there. I think he's about the only one that was killed during that time. Mm-hmm. And the 442nd was there like from the middle of November till April. And that's a time when all these young kids, now the Army changed the designation back to 1A because of what the 442nd was doing. Mm-hmm. So they made them all eligible for the draft and were being drafted. And they were being trained at Camp Shelby. So after about 6 months, they were sent over, and they came in en masse to fill up the 442nd again.
Right. It needed a lot of filling up because of how devastated it was. With those 3 months of recovery for you, were there ever days where you weren't sure you were going to make it? Or you weren't sure you were going to be yourself again?
No, I was in good shape after the surgery. A little painful, of course, but... Mm-hmm.
Did you have broken ribs?
Nothing broke. It just... a lot of muscle tear, which is pretty bad.
And there are a lot of internal organs inside your rib cage. I mean, there's a lot of damage that could have been done there.
It didn't go in. It didn't come through. It went around. Mm-hmm. So it just, you know, just luck.
The angle was everything.
Yeah, just luck.
Was it luck or was somebody looking out for you?
I don't know. You see guys that... they get hit square in the head with a bullet. Jeez. You know.
Well, here's the other thing that strikes me. Your injury, which almost killed you. I mean, we're talking inches probably from killing you. But now you're, how old are you? 92? Mm-hmm. 92, and you're in better shape than I am.
I don't know about that.
Wearing your 442 belt buckle here today. Looking sharp. But had you not been wounded that day, 442 has... a couple more days of combat before they liberate the Lost Battalion, and a lot more guys died in those 2 days.
That's right.
Is it possible that getting wounded when you did could have saved your life?
Very, very likely. From what some of the guys told me, the day that I got hit, after the barrage, they made their way forward, but they had a tough time. That was the 29th, 28th. The next day is the 29th. They could hear firepower, but it was not coming at them. So they knew that must be where the Americans were trapped because the Germans were shooting at them. So now that, you know, the incentive is to get going. They knew they had to get going. So the 29th and 30th, when they broke through on the 30th, that was really a bloody, what we call bonsai charges. I don't know if you understand that word.
Well, but yeah. Usually you hear it associated
all
with
all-out charge,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And in fact, a couple of weeks ago, I was in Denver for the memorial service for Joe Sakato, who was the last of our 21 Medal of Honor awards. And I spoke at his service, and he tells how he went goofy and made that bonsai charge, you know, and just went crazy. But that's what they had to do to make that last charge to get through, break through. But so there were a lot of casualties in that last day or so.
Including him.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you brought Joe up because I had
his,
him.
He got his on the 29th.
Yeah. And so the implication is you could have been one of those and might not be here today. But you bring up Joe Sakato. I interviewed him in Denver a few years ago. And one thing he said, I thought of this when you mentioned you're 5'9", because he talked about being 5'4", and he thought being short saved his life because of all the close calls he had that went right over his head.
You know, when we first got into, we were very green when we went overseas. And so, and there was actually early July, like July 2, 3, 4, when we got together with the 100th Battalion who had been coming up the coast of Italy. And so after Rome, we grouped together as one full regiment. And the first day of battle, we go in an area, a kind of a low area, and Captain Ensminger, our CO, leads us through, and everything's pretty quiet, no shooting. And all of a sudden, from the high side and both sides, Germans start shooting down at us. And, you know, everybody's scattering. They don't know which way to go. And finally, we find a low and a high area that we could get behind. And the 4th Platoon starts setting up mortars and machine gun. Captain Ensminger gets shot in the head and gets killed the first day. I was in the 4th Platoon then. Lieutenant Zukowski, my platoon leader, gets killed the first day. They called the 100th back, and they replaced us. They came in, we withdrew, and the 100th wiped out the German force. So, you know, but that's how our baptism of fire, the first thing I can remember. It was a dry day, open field, and I could see the specks of dust, and there was a burp gun aiming toward us, and, you know, the specks are like this, and all of a sudden you hear the burp, and the burp gun is short-handled, high velocity, and it lifts up.
Right.
So it lifted up right over our heads.
Wow. So you saw it coming right in front of you, and then like a bubble around you, it goes over your head.
What the hell's that dust? You know, the dust is flying, all of a sudden you hear this like popping noise as the bullets go flying by. Oh, we learned a lot the first day.
I guess so. And all the way throughout, but you're surrounded throughout your time over there by death, by devastation. How did you deal with that? How did you keep going when your friends and people you knew were dying around you?
Well, we had to advance. You know, we kept advancing, so we just casualties left and right, but you just keep going.
Did you rejoin the 442 when you got out of the hospital?
Yes.
And that was the fourth time you'd been wounded?
Yeah.
But you didn't get to come home?
No.
Did you want to come home?
I guess I wasn't wounded that bad. Like some guy, you know, if they lost a leg or lost an eye or arm, they would always get shipped back to Battle Creek, Michigan or someplace.
Right.
But I guess a lot of us were wounded like I was in the ward that I was in. Mm-hmm. So it's just a matter of healing. And we're, you know, they figured we're ambulatory, get up and walk, so go back. And, you know, we still didn't have replacements, so we had to go back.
No choice.
You know.
And was your family back home aware of what had happened to you?
I don't think so. I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. I wrote a few letters to my sister, but I never wrote to my parents. But My sister, I'm sure, probably told them.
It's time for us to take our first break. Remember, you can find photos, videos, and links to more information about Mr. Sakai and all the other veterans who appear on this program at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Radio page on Facebook. When we come back, we're going to hear about what Lawson Sakai did after recovering from his injuries and returning to the 442nd, and also the unique way in which he encountered one of those lost battalion soldiers he had helped to rescue. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and part 2 of our conversation with 92-year-old Lawson Sakai of Morgan Hill, California, a Purple Heart recipient and veteran of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team in Europe during World War II. We've heard about how he was nearly killed by a German artillery round during the famous rescue of the Lost Battalion in the Vosges Mountains in October 1944. And he told us it took him about 3 months to recover from his injuries before he would return to combat. So from the time you rejoined the 442nd until the end of the war, where were you? What were you doing?
Well, in April, General Mark Clark from the 5th Army in Italy wanted the 442nd to come back to Italy. So we were shipped back quietly, and I think General Clark didn't want the Germans to know that we were coming back. So we were transported by truck at night a lot, and then when we got close to the front lines, we marched in at night and hid out during the daytime. I remember we marched at night. We didn't know where we were going, but there was a little village called Ozzano, and we moved into Ozzano. The next day, we could see out from the houses. Across the hill was Mount Fogorito, which was the anchor mountain of about 6 mountains, which they called the Gothic Line. And this is where the 5th Army had been trying to penetrate through that series of mountains to get to the Po Valley. Well, the 92nd Division was there, and I guess they were there over 5 months, and they've been trying to scale the mountain and getting shot down day after day. And after watching what was going on, we were told to strip down to the lightest weight, keep our canteens covered, ammo, weapon, that's it. Take everything else off, and quietly we're going to climb that mountain. You know, we're young kids. I've been back there twice, and I looked at that thing, and I said, I don't know how we could climb that thing, even in broad daylight, you know. I remember there was a 14-year-old Italian boy, Partizano, who knew all the, you know, they knew all the goat trails and everything, and he led the way. And I met Guido 2 or 3 times afterwards. He had a small restaurant motel in Massa. So we stayed there a couple times. And unfortunately, he's already passed away. But we had to hang on to each other. You couldn't see. It was the dark of night. And he had to be very quiet. My L Company was in the lead. And my friend Shig Kazuka from Watsonville, was the third soldier at the peak. And he said everybody was crowding up there as close as they could get to the top. And there was an outcropping where they had waited. And at daybreak, they moved up, and there were two machine gunners sound asleep. That's how quiet they were.
Holy cow.
And they wiped them out and went up on top and started shooting at the Germans. And the Germans were either getting up, having breakfast, or, you know, just really not prepared for an assault. And the chase was on. They loaded up their trucks and just, you know, got out of there as fast as they could. And it broke the Gothic line. And as Eric Saul, I don't know if you've ever met him, he's a historian. He says the 442nd broke through in 32 minutes. Mm-hmm. So from there, we chased the Germans up through the hillside, Massa Carrara, on up the coast to Genoa. Then they moved into the Po Valley, and they got to a place called the Getty Airport in Brescia, and they surrendered. Then the war was over.
Climbing that peak, taking that spot, and then finding out that those machine guns are there. I bet you're glad you didn't make any noise on the way up, huh?
Well, you know, dead of night, you would think, you know, I don't know how quiet you can be, but
because all it would have taken was one, right? I mean, one guy screwing up and everybody dies.
Yeah.
So when you get that news, Germany surrendered, what does that mean to you after everything you'd been through at that point?
Oh, well, I watched our CO at that time was Tom Akins, a Texan, a real loud, wild man. And somehow he found a bottle of whiskey. I think he drank the whole damn thing and passed out. But that's how we felt, you know. Just, oh, you know, it's over. Mm-hmm. And there must have been 2,000-3,000 Germans and maybe 200-300 of us. And they kept bringing their guns, everything they had, and stacking it up. And we were supposed to, you know, get all this categorized, put them in spots. That was our job, was to, you know, take care of the surrendering.
And you told us that when you went over, when you were on the ship heading overseas, you were convinced you weren't coming back, that you would die somewhere along the way. When Germany finally surrendered, did you allow yourself to believe that, hey, I'm going to make it through all this?
Yeah, it was like, it's a miracle. You know, we're still alive, some of us. Amazing.
And how different was America when you came back?
Well, I'm still a kid. You know, we're not, I'm still only 21. It was kind of like a strange country again. In my case, fortunately, we had a home, the 5 acres, and we had a house and a half. My parents had given it to another family who were working the same kind of, I think his name was, what was his name?
This is back home in Los Angeles, you mean?
Yeah.
And they watched it for you?
Well, they took it over.
Uh-huh.
So I wasn't home. It was mid-July, I think, when my aunt and my parents came back from Colorado. The guy tried to kick them out. He said, you can't come here. It's my property. Get out of here. So my aunt, she must have had the papers of ownership. That's another story. She and her husband came here, I think, in 1899 or something like that. And they worked, and they bought that 5 acres of property in their name. They're immigrants, and yet they bought it in their name because the anti-Japanese law was not in effect till 1908, something like that.
Uh-huh.
So the government could not escheat the property away from them, even though they were not American citizens.
Mm-hmm.
So she had the sheriff evict these people, and she got back into her home. So they were there. When I came home in December 1945, they were already in the home. So I had a home to come home to, mm-hmm. which most of the Japanese people did not. They had no place to go.
And there are those great stories of friends of the family, other families from town watching the property and taking care of it while they were gone. But there's so many that lost everything. And I know you have that perspective.
Yeah.
And you say you get home and you go back to the family in Southern California, but I bet you wanted to track down that girl from Colorado, too.
They had come back to Gilroy.
Uh-huh.
Of course, they had recovered their property and were living there. So when I came back in December, I started driving up to Gilroy from L.A. and going back and forth. And eventually, in 1946, we got married.
1946.
Yeah.
70 years ago. What's your secret?
Well, I don't know. You just have to stay alive.
Well, you were pretty good at that during World War II. I've got to ask you, so much has been said now, and really since that time, about the 442nd. When you hear go for broke, what do those three words mean to you?
Well, I have a lot of memories of losing all of my paycheck on the crap table. It wasn't a table, it was a blanket on the hut floor. The Hawaiian boys are very good at rolling the dice. Mm-hmm. And we threw our money in there and boom, it's all gone. You go for broke. And of course, the boys would keep shooting until somebody got it all. Then they go hunt for another game to try to win everything there. Go for broke. All mm-hmm. or nothing.
Mm-hmm. And that really personified your unit militarily.
Yeah. Yeah, that was where the term came from.
Mm-hmm.
When the guys would eventually close shop or, you know, quit, they'd buckets of money, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But take everybody and go to town and, you know, eat, drink, whatever, just spend all the money. And, of course, the Hawaiian boys always had money because the money orders keep coming.
Right.
So, and we're always broke, and the mainland boys had very little money. I forgot what we were getting, $21 or $30 or whatever we were getting. After you pay your laundry bill and so forth, maybe you got 15 or 20 bucks left, and it doesn't take long before that's gone. So,
yeah.
You know, that we're not going anyplace, but the Hawaiian boys would drag you with them into town. Of course, they're always paying the bill. They're spending all their money.
Well, and to follow that parallel to the combat you were in against the Germans, you're one of those guys who got to walk away with a bucket of money. And there are a lot of those guys who had the money who aren't here anymore.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
When you think about all those guys from the 442nd and the other 400,000 Americans who died in World War II, what do you think people need to remember today?
Well, we've had a couple of generations since that have never had to go to war. And in 1941 and 2, the whole world was at war. We were either going to win or lose. And if we lost, we'd either be speaking German or Japanese today.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, you had to either win or lose. No question there.
What was it that you think enabled your side, our side, to win?
I don't know. The Germans had superior weapons. It beats the hell out of me how we've defeated them. It's just, you know, sheer guts, I guess. You know, we made so many bonsai charges. It's just amazing. And, of course, I think a lot of the Germans were pretty demoralized by it. They knew, because they ever keep retreating, they knew that they were going to lose. And a lot of them thought, I'm going to surrender. Because on many of the assaults, a lot of them would either wave a handkerchief or comrade, comrade. They're going like this, you know. And you can't shoot them at that point. You know? And they just gave up. A lot of them, they knew the end was near for them.
I don't want to forget to say thank you for serving our country. And thank you for helping us understand a little bit of what it was like for you and people like you. I do have a few more questions. You mentioned an event with one of those 211 men mm-hmm. that you guys rescued in the Vosges Mountains, Al Tortolano. He's probably not the only Lost Battalion guy you've met.
There's very few left. There used to be three or four in this Northern California area, but I think he's the only one left anymore. And he's not very strong. So this might be the last time that we'll get together like this.
Maybe you were fortunate enough to catch Mr. Sakai and Mr. Tortolano appearing together, but if not, you can still get a little taste because Al Tortolano shared his story on Hometown Heroes 5 years ago. And when we come back, we're going to get both veterans' accounts of how rescuer met rescuee, and we'll hear the gratitude of a man who knows he wouldn't be here without the courageous go-for-broke spirit of the 442nd. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's RV country within driving distance of this radio station. But really, it doesn't matter where you live, because Paul Everett has a fly and buy program that will fly you to any of his locations to buy your new RV. It's one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Serving RVers for 55 years, you'll find Paul Everett's RV country throughout the West and online at rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, finishing up a two-part conversation with 92-year-old Lawson Sakai of Morgan Hill, California, who was wounded in the most famous action the 442nd Regimental Combat Team was involved in during World War II, the rescue of the Lost Battalion, when Sakai and his fellow Japanese-Americans suffered heavy, heavy casualties, but somehow still managed to rescue over 200 soldiers who had been surrounded by German forces in the Vosges Mountains of France in October 1944. We've mentioned his friendship with one of the men who was rescued there, Al Tortolano of Santa Clara, California.
But the first time that you met him, what was that encounter like?
Well, somehow I had been given the name Al Tortolano, and that he lived up here, and that he volunteered as a jitney driver at the VA hospital, Palo Alto. So one day when I was up there, I parked my car, and this jitney came around, so I hopped on.
You had a medical appointment at the VA?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I asked the driver, I said, do you know of an Al Tortolano that is driving one of his Jeeps around? He said, yeah, that's me. It was him.
You know what's funny? He told me that same story from his perspective years ago. That's hilarious. Well, what did that mean to you, to meet one of these guys that you were wounded for and so many of your friends died for?
I've met, I guess, 15 or 20, maybe something like that. We've had 2 or 3 reunions, like in Houston and other places, with these guys. So I've met a lot of them. Marty Higgins was the lead lieutenant left. Erwin Blonder was a forward observer lieutenant. And they used to come to our reunion that we hold every year in Las Vegas. He told me he finally came full circle by coming to our reunion and, you know, thanking everybody and so forth. In fact, Erwin, one of his granddaughters is a teacher in Oakland. She comes to our memorial service every so often. And we have other children of the soldiers that we rescued are still, we keep in touch.
How does that make you feel when a guy like that says, I wouldn't be here without you?
Well, who knows? I wouldn't be here if somebody didn't protect me, too. You know, it just kind of good luck, I guess, you know. Or you couldn't save them all, but you do what you can.
And you can imagine the gratitude felt by those men from the Lost Battalion. Since Al Tortolano told some of his story on Hometown Heroes years ago, I figured I'd dig back into the archives and share with you just a little bit of his perspective, including his take on that meeting with one of his liberators at the Palo Alto VA. You can find this entire interview from April 2011 at hometownheroesradio.com. But here's Al Tortolano on what it felt like to be rescued by the 442nd.
Oh, I don't know. It was almost like being reborn, I think, because you don't know what to think. You know, while you're there and the way things are going, your mind is first on your family. You know, will I ever see them again? What will happen? How will they take it? You know, knowing that I'm never going to come back. And it was just, I don't know, the feeling that we had. But then when we found out that they finally broke through, oh, man, it was like the sun coming out after a storm, you know. You figure it was 7 days of what we went through. It was really hell up there because we couldn't really dig in deep because it was mountain, you know, and there was a lot of rock and stuff. You couldn't really dig a foxhole. And even if you did, the tree bursts, you have to worry about tree bursts, you know. When all of a sudden we heard one guy say, oh my God, we're fighting the Japs. Because we didn't even know at the time that there was a 442nd. Mm-hmm. And yet they were attached to our division at times. Mm-hmm. But we didn't even know. And that's why that's one guy that made that remark. When we saw Japanese soldiers who were fighting the Japs. But then we found out they're our rescuers, and all we wanted to do was get out of there. And so we took off. I mean, we didn't stop to say thank you then or anything. All we wanted to do was get our butts off that mountain.
And I'm sure it wasn't until later that you realized the severe losses that they absorbed. They lost more men than they saved in terms of rescuing you. When you figured that out, how did that weigh on you? How did you process that, knowing that many men had sacrificed their lives for yours?
When I finally got to the, you know, thinking, really thinking about it, I know when they first rescued us, I was so happy and thankful. And then when we found out years, we didn't know until way later how many they actually lost. And I thought about it. I felt so bad because I said, here's a group of people that were used during the war. I don't know how to put it, but it seemed like when any dirty job had to be done or any fighting that they feel was almost impossible, the 442nd was always involved. Then I find out what their parents went through, and for them to volunteer to fight for their country like they did. I didn't know how to think about it. I just grab them and want to hug them, you know, and show them how you really felt about them.
You talk about wanting to hug them. I'm sure you've had the opportunity to meet some of the soldiers from the 442nd. What is that like for you? And is there anything that needs to be said? Is it a look in your eye, a hug, a pat on the back, or have you had a chance to actually speak to them how much you appreciated them saving your life?
Oh, yes, I sure did. For about 8 years, I've been a volunteer up at the VA hospital in Palo Alto. Well, one day I'm driving the little shuttle around, and this Japanese-American, Lawson Sakai, says, are you Al Tortolano? And I said, yeah. He said, well, I'm Lawson Sakai. He says, somebody told me that you were driving. He said, I was with the 442nd. Oh, my God. He says, is there any chance we can get together and talk? I says, oh, yeah, yeah. So anyway, we started talking, and that's how I got started getting involved with the 442nd. From there, they started inviting me to their different functions. I went to their reunions in Las Vegas as their guest. They made me an honorary member of the 442nd. And we got to swap stories, and I got to meet so many wonderful people.
And what does that do for you when you get a chance to talk to them and thank them? Do you feel like you're just speaking for yourself, or do you feel like you're speaking for all 220 guys who were saved by their brave actions?
Oh, no, I'm speaking for everybody. Yeah, because I know how they felt, not only speaking for those 220, I think I'm speaking for every other soldier that was in combat over there, thinking, man, if every division had a 442nd, what a great thing that would be. It would have been for everybody. Every time I see one, I don't care if I saw him yesterday and I see him again today, it's like another new beginning, you know. I look at him and say, wow, this is one of the guys that the reason I'm maybe standing here today. Maybe we would have gotten out of it. We never know. But as far as I'm concerned, they were our saviors. And they deserve every little hello or thank you that they can get.
Pretty clear how he feels, isn't it? Again, that's Al Tortolano. And now, back to his good friend and one of his rescuers, Lawson Sakai.
I know that you go around speaking quite a bit about your experience.
Not anymore. I've kind of given that up. I used to do a lot, but, you know, it's kind of hectic now.
When you have done that, what is the number one message that you try to convey?
Well, there's so many young people out there now that don't realize what life was like 70 years ago, and I try to point out the things that happened in 1941 and so forth, and then, of course, the good war, the war to end all wars.
Mm-hmm. And since then, I mean, it took decades, but eventually the government said, hey, we messed up. We shouldn't have done this to Japanese Americans. And then a couple decades later, they said, hey, all you Nisei who went and fought, we want to bring you to Washington and give you the Congressional Gold Medal. What about those two points along your life's journey with the government having those gestures with you in mind? What did that mean?
Well, you know, the whole country is formed by immigrants. So it's pretty hard to say one group of immigrants can say we're American, but you immigrants are not Americans. You know, that doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that correction was a huge step in forming the United States. Something that had to be recognized. And in 1941, this whole country was run by the East Coast people. And a lot of those people, including President Roosevelt, had very little knowledge or contact with Asian people at that point, because almost all of us were on the West Coast, and East Coasters didn't want to mingle with the savages on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
They were, you know, it was like, oh, those animals out in the West Coast, you know. So I think the war did bring both sides together. East went west, west went east, and things changed a lot.
Last thing I want to ask you, and if there's anything else that you'd like to mention, feel free, but what would you say you're most proud of, and what are you most thankful for?
Well, I'm very thankful I'm still alive. I remember Chaplain Higuchi was our 2nd Battalion chaplain, and we used to have, in those days, I think we used to pray a lot.
I wonder why.
He would pull his Jeep up and, you know, whoever was around the able to, we'd kind of gather around, and he'd give a little, not a sermon, but he'd talk a little bit and try to calm us down, I guess. We all could appreciate being alive. We've seen the death part already. So to be alive another day, you know, and I'm sure that part of his job is to keep the morale up so you don't get too despondent or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They got to keep the boys going. I have a funny story. On the way over to Italy, we're on this Liberty ship. E Company's on there. Regimental headquarters is on there. So Colonel Pence and his staff are all on ship up above. We're down below. And a lot of the Hawaiian boys are shooting craps. You know, they're going overseas and they're letting it go. And one day, Chaplain West comes down and goes over to where the boys are shooting craps and starts chewing them out. And I suppose he wanted the boys to sit there and pray or something. Anyway, you know, they were saying foul mouth words, you know, get out of here, you know. And he's, you know, egging them on. Finally, two guys grab him, take him over to the, they're going to throw overboard. And the voice of them, put that man down, Colonel Pence. Saved the man's life. We never saw him again.
I haven't heard a story quite like that before. Classic. Classic. Was there anything else you wanted to say?
Oh, no, you know, it's a long story, but I think we did what we intended to do. I'm sorry that, like my parents and all the other Issei who are now all gone, didn't really live long enough to capitalize on what we had gotten for them. 1952, I believe, they were allowed to become naturalized citizens of the United States. You know, a huge turnaround from deportation to naturalization, you know, and all because of what their children, the Issei boys, did for them. Mm-hmm. And I think that is very important to impress on, like, my children and their children, that they know that that first generation that was born here suffered along with their parents because they couldn't get jobs either. But by doing what they did, going to war and so forth, they, you know, they created the life for them that's so good.
Yeah.
You know, like, I have four children. They all graduated college. They're all doing good. I have seven grandchildren. They've all graduated college, and they're all doing good. You know, you couldn't have done that in 1941.
Well, none of them would have been born if you didn't survive the war. But, you know, I always end the show by saying freedom isn't free. And what you're saying is, for Japanese Americans, freedom and opportunity isn't free, that a lot of lives paid for it in World War II.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Something for all of us to remember today. Head on over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for more on Lawson Sakai and his friend Al Tortolano. And join us again next time when a couple of old, bold pilots, their words, not mine, help us understand the truth behind those four words I'm going to repeat for you one more time. Freedom is not free.